everybody, and thank you for coming and being part of our Empathy Week. Tonight we have the privilege of being joined by Danny Dorling, Professor of the School of Geography and the Environment at the University of Oxford. And Danny has just published his new and revised edition of Injustice, Why Social Inequality Still Persists, which you can buy after the talk. And for now, I hope you'll have a lovely evening, and here's Danny Dorling.
Thank you. I think you can see me, so I'm going to ask for your empathy and I'm going to just carry on sitting down for the next 20 minutes. So I'm only going to talk for about 20 minutes. I've got an 8-minute video to show you, and then please ask me questions about what I'm going on about. The book is called Injustice, Why Social Inequality Still Persists. It doesn't have the word empathy in the title, but it actually has quite a lot about empathy in it. Or more appropriately, lack of empathy. It's the main argument in the book is that there are a group of people who have a set of beliefs which are not very empathetic to others, but they're truly deeply held. And because their beliefs have come to the fore, and their beliefs are dominating government and dominating thinking, and dominating most political parties at the moment in the country, that we have inequality at a very, very high level, much higher than anywhere else in Western Europe, and it's rising because essentially it's seen as okay by a small group of people. But they're not stupid. Most of them understand not to say it's okay because they understand it really annoys people, most people. They may not understand why it annoys most people. It must be very difficult for them to appreciate why most people don't think like them. And so this is all about trying to think in other people's shoes and guess at where you are. I was 13 when Raiders of the Lost Ark came out. Anybody else remember that coming out? Have you got an age range? A few. It's great. I'm now in the oldest third of the audience. That's very nice to be. Okay. See, you see when you get to the reason why. It came out in 1981. Big film, very exciting film. I still like Raiders of the Lost Ark. So we'll get to that in a minute. Here's the promise. The promise was that I'm going to talk about how we live in the most remarkable and dangerous times. Globally, the richest 1% have never, I think, had as much of world wealth as they have now. You can argue about whether the other 99% have seen wealth absolutely collapse or fall by a small amount. This is worldwide figures. But if you just look in Britain, in the last 5 years, the transfer of wealth to the best off 1% of 1% of 1% is staggering. That group, the Sunday Times Super Rich, has seen their wealth double in the last 5 years. Below them, the best off landlords, who are about a third of the best off 1%, have captured over 300 billion of extra wealth in the last 5 years. The middle class, people who own their houses outright, have seen almost no increase in their wealth net. And these are people without a mortgage. People with a mortgage, which is now an incredibly privileged group to get into. I find it embarrassing to admit that I have a mortgage. It tells you how well off I am, that I'm allowed to borrow a huge amount of money. The group I'm in have seen a huge reduction in our wealth because we have to borrow so much now to be able to buy a house. So we've actually become relatively poorer. We think we're going to be fine. We think we're going to stay with that person for 25 years that we got the mortgage deal with. We think we're going to keep our jobs and so on. And then for the bulk of you in this room who will be renting, you really are being ripped off. You may not truly realise it. You probably feel a bit ripped off. But the ripped offness in the past when I rented was that you would get out of this, you would somehow become stable. And of course, my generation, nobody made us borrow £50,000-£60,000 student loans and all the rest of it. And that's just within one of the richest countries on earth, let alone the other 99%. Hence, I don't think it's wrong to talk about collapsed. Maybe the hope is a bit much to ask for at the moment, but I'll try and give you reasons for hope. And part of the reasons for hope is that it's got to such a ridiculous level. At the weekend, I was telling some of my friends I went to school with, I was doing this talk this evening, and they did burst out laughing. So you can guess what kind of school child I was compared to my friends. I was the one who was very good at maths. Let's put it that way. I was a certain way along that spectrum. The idea of me talking about empathy or being seen as particularly empathetic to my friends is a joke, because they're all far more empathetic than me, far more understanding, more careful people. We all vary in how we are. There are degrees of difference. Most people are pro-social. When it's measured by the academics who like to measure things, most people are empathetic, most are pro-social. A small minority are pretty antisocial, and some of us are in between. But not being particularly empathetic was useful for writing this injustice book, because what I did to write that was read many, many things, mostly about 8, 9, 10 years ago, quite a lot more recently. And whenever I spotted somebody saying something that was actually logically pretty nasty, I just took a note of it and collected them together. And because I don't easily get embarrassed, I thought it was okay to list all these nasty things and put them into chapters and say, this is what these people really believe, but they tend to hide it 300 pages into their book or in some political note somewhere else that they think only true believers will read. I was in Sheffield at the time I wrote the first edition of this book, and because I grew up in Oxford, I thought I'd pick on Oxford University and find examples of academics at Oxford who said some pretty nasty things about other human beings and how crap most people were and useless, and how only a few people are good enough to rule and learn and so on. But of course, since coming here, I've discovered that everybody is lovely and nobody has any elitist views whatsoever in the university. Let's zoom on. But it is ironic that I did pick on the University of Oxford as the example of some fairly nasty views being expressed in obscure journals by people who tended to advise the then new Labour government. Here's some data from the OECD. It's data about the ability of children in the Netherlands. The OECD no longer produce graphs of this data. It's interesting. They still produce the data, but they don't produce the numbers quite so easily as to be able to draw the graphs. You can get it from their reports, but it's harder. And for the Netherlands, around about 2012, this is the data. I first looked in 2006. They think that about 3% of children have no ability whatsoever. 11% are extremely limited. Doing better than that, there was a 20% of kids in the Netherlands whose ability and knowledge is barely adequate to function in society. And then above that, there are 28% of people whose knowledge is simple when measured at age 15. And finally, you get to a quarter who are effective, and then 11% who are truly developed, and then the amazing 2% who are advanced, the kind of alpha-alpha children. This is what is produced in the PISA tables. When you see international league tables of ability, this is what's produced, and this is the kind of definition. You've got to have very good eyesight to see this, but here's the distribution for all of the OECD, the Netherlands, the UK and the USA. Below it are the changes, and they're all bell curves. The reason that they're all bell curves is not because that's what the data showed when they measured the ability of these children with a series of tests. It's because that's what they transformed the data into before they published it. That's what PISA does. Because the people in charge of PISA, the people who do the international comparisons, believe that ability is distributed along a bell curve. But you have to read the incredibly boring technical report. The reason you read the incredibly boring technical report is because you were a fairly unempathetic young man who was good at maths, who, when he spots a series of curves looking like that, goes, that hasn't come out of the data, has it? So you know that at some point they're going to have to explain how they fiddled the data to produce something that looks quite like that. But that is sitting behind our elite thinking about things like education. People are of this distribution, of it everywhere. Only a few can be truly able. You can push them all up a little bit, but what we really need to do is to go out and search for the people with true potential, the golden children. Get them in, train them up, set them to rule, and whatever you do, don't let the people beneath think that they're up to looking after themselves. These curves are relatively recent. The one to your right is the first one ever drawn in 1891 by Carl Pearson. It's the distribution of paupers in Britain by area. I'm fairly sure Carl fiddled his data because it just fits the curve too closely. And he wanted to show that the distribution of paupers, these are people relying on various forms of poor law handouts, was normally distributed because presumably they were being generated somewhere and not dying fast enough. I'm not sure what was in Carl's mind. We don't have, well, we do sadly have paupers again. We didn't have many until recently, but it's rising again. But this isn't a way of thinking that's been with us for a huge amount of time. Let's zoom through. We have very different stories about why people succeed and why they fail. This little diagram is a made-up diagram. Along the bottom, you've got people's income and it changing over their life course over time. If you think, if you're a student here, your income's pretty low. You can expect it to rise in 10 or 20 years' time, so you're going to move that way away from me. And along the side, you've got standard living. Standard living tends to rise after income rises, so people tend to rotate in an anti-clockwise direction. When their income falls, you split up, you get ill, you lose your job. Those are the three main reasons. When the income falls, you tend to keep your standard living up because you're used to it, get into debt, and it takes some time to adjust your standard living down again. So you kind of cycle round in eddies. But people are in different parts of this distribution, and we have different stories to describe them. So you can describe people in the bottom corner, the corporal and poor corner, if you like, as mainly wasters, people who just haven't tried hard enough or don't have it in them. Scroungers or skivers. No, it's no wonder they're down there. But there are a few people who try really hard and then they get out, and it's largely due to their hard work. Not luck or anything else, largely due to their hard work. And then they can join another set of people who really are quite deserving because they've worked really hard and they behave properly, and you never know, they might even save because they've got some good morals and they're up there in the top. And occasionally people drop out of the top. It's normally due to some kind of moral failing, probably. You know, not behaving well enough. If you just stayed married, or worked hard enough and not got sacked. I shouldn't be cynical. I do feel guilty. I can't help it. You know, we are stuck with who we are. And this is very cruel. Anyway, I feel sorriest for the people in the Barclays Tower in Canary Wharf, where they sack 1 in 10 a year, because they have a kind of survival of the fittest idea, that if you sack 1 in 10 a year, you'll get truly able bankers at the top levels of that tower, who will do truly remarkable things, like fix Forex or LIBOR or whatever else it is that they've done. So this isn't a nice story at the top as well as at the bottom. When you look at how people are doing, how they say they're doing in surveys, this is a collection of surveys taken all the way from 1984 to 2004. You find in Britain, words are interesting. We tend to get terribly, terribly embarrassed by this. I'm still trying to find a teacher in Oxford, including a retired teacher, who will tell me that it is hard to live as a school teacher in Oxford. And as yet I cannot get one. Well, I don't want to just tell me, they'll tell me. I'd like them to also tell the Oxford Mail. And the reason I'd like them to tell the Oxford Mail is because I think one of our major problems in Oxford is that teachers don't stay in all but three of the schools. that's private and state, because their pay only covers their rent, which is why in some schools you'll find the majority of teachers are under 25. And it's great having 22 and 23 and 24 year old teachers, but you just want a few in their 30s and the occasional teacher in their 40s, and the odd teacher who's got a kid themselves. It makes a difference to a school. But teachers, middle class people, don't want to say, either, actually I do find it quite hard to pay the rent and I'm a bit sick of this and I'm going to go for a job in a Lake District next year, or I'm managing to survive but only because mum and dad gave me £70,000 as a deposit on that flat in the Cowley Road. This is all embarrassing, so nobody will actually say about their situation. So what happens when we survey people before the crash is only 6% said they're finding it very difficult to get by. Another 15% say they find it difficult to manage. 48% use the word coping. So my apologies to my friends who are not from England about... you may have been around long enough to know the word coping doesn't really mean doing pretty well. And then we have 31% who say they're comfortable. Now, only 31% are comfortable in one of the richest countries of the world. And this is before the crash. It's much worse since the crash. These little dots are surveys. Each dot is a survey of 15-year-old girls. First one was taken in 1982. They're all properly done surveys, very carefully, clinically done. And they come from a paper which was designed to show that there was no rise in anxiety and depression over time. What I've done here is to take out all the circles that were not in North America. They're in countries like Japan and Germany and France. So you've only got the surveys in North America. And what you can see there is a rise over time in anxiety and depression. The latest dot is a big survey that happened quite recently. It's just fortuitous it actually ends up on the line, but the thing is definitely rising. We really are seeing dramatic increases in expressed anxiety, depression, self-harm, worry, particularly amongst young women, but also amongst young men, because there are good reasons to be really scared. That's the logical, you don't have to be, it's not rocket science. Until 2010, we had some massive surveys of anxiety in schools. Eric Pickles cancelled them almost immediately when he came in to DCLG. But they were showing worrying signs of acceleration in fearfulness amongst young people. Because the future is looking very scary. Competition looks very scary. I think we're almost at the last graph now. Up to the dark bar is the first edition of the book. And then from the dark bar onwards is the data since the first edition was published to most recently. This is the proportion of people taking Prozac every year in Scotland, where we have the best data. Prozac and other SSRIs. It's got up to 13% of the population. This is medicated by the state to feel better than you would otherwise feel, to take yourself away from the situation you are in. This isn't people self-medicating with alcohol, which is on top of that. This isn't other ways people cope. And it was kind of, it appeared to be calming down slightly when the first edition was produced, and then of course we get the crash in it and it goes up. So we're not in a good state. It's not great, and what's worse is worrying about why. Why is it this bad? Why should we all be so worried? Why do our youngsters worry? Why do those bankers in that tower in Canary Wharf worry? You know, why can't Barclays just calm down a bit and not sack 10% of people in that tower every year? Just pay them all a bit less and keep them all. When I was in Japan a few years ago, the university I was working in had a problem. They'd made a problem with their budget. Somebody had made a mistake. So they did what all Japanese universities and workplaces do in this situation. They didn't sack anybody. Nobody was paid for a month. Everybody was not paid for a month. And then they were all paid again. Because no rational person would sack their friends and colleagues. You work together. In a country with the kind of empathy that the Japanese have, not in the kind of country that the USA and others have become. Last graph. Along the bottom, you've got the take of the 1%. It goes up to over 20% in the USA. And along the side, you've got the proportion of people who walk and cycle to work. So the Netherlands, the 1% are very well controlled. Everybody has 1%. You're always going to have a group who have the most. And you can always identify them by looking for the best 1%. What matters is how much the 1% have. The 1% will always contain a disproportional number of extremely greedy people. It's quite hard to get into the top 1% if you don't really like having money, because that's what being in the 1% is about. Over time, different countries have managed to control their 1% better than others, and we used to control ours very well in the 70s. They never had less, which means everybody else gets a bit more, but it also means that the attitudes of people who are greedy are controlled. And some things are highly correlated to inequality in the 1%. Some aren't. Drinking and cigarette smoking isn't. But walking and cycling is. And I think it's the things that you can't organise on your own. You can quite easily organise on your own to buy a packet of cigarettes and smoke. You do need there to be cigarettes that you can get, but it's a fairly, you know, individualistic thing. You cannot paint a cycle lane on your own, unless you're very, very radical, but it's quite hard to do. You cannot organise a society so that they build houses around the edge of Oxford for people who work in Oxford on your own, rather than making them live in Birmingham and come by car to park and ride. You can't do that individually. You need to be the Netherlands. You need a sensible society, not an individualistic society. So we get these correlations. Okay, the movie. And this is where I'm going to end, so please, please have a think. I only came across this movie in the last week. So it's a movie made in 1949 called Fountainhead. The script for the movie was done by an unusual woman called Ayn Rand. And there's a still from the movie, that's Gary Cooper. There's the lady now. Anybody know who this young, I call him young, he's a year younger than me, who this young man is? Anybody recognise him?
Sajid Javid.
Yep, Sajid Javid. A tip to be a potential future Prime Minister. So it's worth getting a good idea of him. Aged around about 46, was the Secretary of State for Culture last year, has just been promoted because to the Secretary of State of Business, because we have business above culture and the arts in this country. So he's now the Secretary of State for Business, I think in the Cabinet, presumably. And we need to try to understand him, particularly if he might become our Prime Minister. You know, Boris, you know, might be entertaining, but think forward 10 years. And that is the most smiley picture I can get of him. So that's that. I did try. If anybody can find a picture of him looking happier, please email me. Now, on the Conservative Home website, January this year, he said that he read the courtroom scene from this film, The Fountainhead, to his future wife, to explain himself to her. I double-checked this before I brought it to you, and I emailed a friend of mine who's a journalist, and she said she was in the room when he said it. She wasn't the one who reported it, so this looks pretty true. He read this scene I'm going to show you to his future wife to explain his philosophy and felt happy enough to tell it publicly. The 49 film is an adaptation of the book. The script was by Rand herself. It stars Gary Cooper. He's an individualistic architect, and you'll see why. The scene starts with the prosecution resting, and then him defending himself for his stance. He's built a building, something's gone wrong, he's blown it up or destroyed it, and he's in trouble for this, and he's going to explain how he thinks. Now, what I thought of doing was stopping this video, but I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to let it play for 8 minutes, and then stop and ask questions. So hopefully you can see why it shocked me so much to see this. But we also have... we have to try to think why Javid loves this so much. He played the VHS tape of it so much that he wore it out at this part. This was 1981. So when I was 13 and watching Raiders of the Lost Ark, as a very weird, very mathsy, very strange school child, but I still liked Raiders of the Lost Ark, Javed discovered this film. And he's powerful and he's representative of people in power. He had a lucrative career in the financial sector. He was a trader in New York at Chase Manhattan. By the age of 25, he was the youngest vice president. It really is weird. 25? What's going on? He was headhunted to join Deutsche Bank. He's made millions. So he's being a servant, being a public servant. Stopped making money, and he's helping run business for all of you. He said, when he first saw this at the age of 12, that the film was articulating what I felt. He wore out the VHS copy for these 8 minutes. And he said, apparently with a self-depreciating grin, so I'd love to see this picture of this self-depreciating grin, that he read it to his future wife. And he now reads the scene twice a year. Okay, and you just Google him and you'll find the clips, but let's play it. And hopefully it'll be loud enough. So 8 minutes, and then please think of some questions.
The confession of Peter Keating has made clear that Howard Roark is a ruthless egoist who has destroyed Cortland Holmes for his own selfish motive. The issue which you are to decide is the crucial issue of our age. Has man any right to exist if he refuses to serve society? Let your verdict give us the answer. The state rests.
The defense may proceed.
Your Honor, I shall call no witnesses. This will be my testimony and my summation.
Take the oath.
Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do. Thousands of years ago, the first man discovered how to make fire. He was probably burned at the stake he had taught his brothers to light, but he left them a gift they had not conceived, and he lifted darkness off the earth. Throughout the centuries, there were men who took first steps down new roads, armed with nothing but their own vision. The great creators, the thinkers, the artists, the scientists, the inventors, stood alone against the men of their time. Every new thought was opposed. Every new invention was denounced. But the men of unborrowed vision went ahead. They fought, they suffered, and they paid, but they won. No creator was prompted by a desire to please his brothers. His brothers hated the gift he offered. His truth was his only motive. His work was his only goal. His work, not those who used it. His creation, not the benefits others derived from it. The creation which gave form to his truth. He held his truth above all things and against all men. He went ahead, whether others agreed with him or not, with his integrity as his only banner. He served nothing and no one. He lived for himself. And only by living for himself was he able to achieve the things which are the glory of mankind. Such is the nature of achievement. Man cannot survive except through his mind. He comes on earth unarmed. His brain is his only weapon. But the mind is an attribute of the individual. There is no such thing as a collective brain. The man who thinks must think and act on his own. The reasoning mind cannot work under any form of compulsion. It cannot be subordinated to the needs, opinions, or wishes of others. It is not an object of sacrifice. The Creator stands on his own judgment. The parasite follows the opinions of others. The Creator thinks. The parasite copies. The Creator produces. The parasite loots. The Creator's concern is the conquest of nature. The parasite's concern is the conquest of man. The Creator requires independence. He neither serves nor rules. He deals with men by free exchange and voluntary choice. The parasite seeks power. He wants to bind all men together in common action and common slavery. He claims that man is only a tool for the use of others. That he must think as they think, act as they act, and live in selfless, joyless servitude to any need but his own. Look at history. Everything we have, every great achievement has come from the independent work of some independent mind. Every horror and destruction came from attempts to force men into a herd of brainless, soulless robots, without personal rights, without personal ambition, without will, hope, or dignity. It is an ancient conflict. It has another name, the individual against the collective. Our country, the noblest country in the history of men, was based on the principle of individualism, the principle of man's inalienable rights. It was a country where a man was free to seek his own happiness, to gain and produce, not to give up and renounce, to prosper, not to starve, to achieve, not to plunder, to hold as his highest possession a sense of his personal value, and as his highest virtue his self-respect. Look at the results. That is what the collectivists are now asking you to destroy, as much of the earth has been destroyed. I am an architect. I know what is to come by the principle on which it is built. We are approaching a world in which I cannot permit myself to live. My ideas are my property. They were taken from me by force, by breach of contract. No appeal was left to me. It was believed that my work belonged to others to do with as they pleased. They had a claim upon me without my consent, that it was my duty to serve them without choice or reward. Now you know why I dynamited Cortland. I designed Cortland. I made it possible. I destroyed it. I agreed to design it for the purpose of seeing it built as I wished. That was the price I set for my work. I was not paid. My building was disfigured at the whim of others who took all the benefits of my work and gave me nothing in return. I came here to say that I do not recognize anyone's right to 1 minute of my life, nor to any part of my energy, nor to any achievement of mine, no matter who makes the claim. It had to be said. The world is perishing from an orgy of self-sacrificing. I came here to be heard in the name of every man of independence still left in the world. I wanted to state my terms. I do not care to work or live on any others. My terms are a man's right to exist for his own sake.
Further, you are instructed that the extent of the monetary loss suffered by the owners is not a matter to be considered by you. The liability of the defendant for any financial loss is a question to be determined in a civil suit. You are concerned here only with a criminal action. You are to determine whether the defendant is guilty or innocent of the specific crime with which he has been charged. You are the exclusive judges of the facts. And under the instructions I have given you, it is your duty and your duty alone to determine the guilt or innocence of the accused.
Thank you. What is your verdict?
Not guilty.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And she chose to marry him. So our Secretary of State for Businesses is now married. Last thing I'll say is I really wanted to play a clip saying that there was no collective mind in the Norrington room. I thought this was the nicest place to play it. Thank you ever so much for listening to me go on. Please ask me to explain myself in whatever way you want. Thank you.
Imagine I'm sitting down for dinner for some weird reason with a 45-year-old investment banker who works at Canary Wharf, one of those towers, and he's a really nice guy. Maybe a guy I went to college with 25 years ago here who went up in the city. And I want to convince him that he should pay more tax and contribute to the struggle against inequality. What should I say to him? How could I actually convince him to do something different?
I think you need to realise that you're not going to do it in that short amount of time. Because of the differences in people's fundamental beliefs about what's right and what's wrong. And the fact that I've been doing this for years, and I was still shocked this week to see that clip for the first time, which I should have seen before, just shows how different we all are. And we tend to assume we're similar to each other. So I'm hoping enough of you are similar enough to me to have got what I think I'm trying to say to you. I'm sure some of you will be more empathetic and think, why does he find it that hard? And there will be people here thinking, what a hippie idiot. If everybody believed like him, the whole country would fall apart and we won't win the global race. But so it takes more time. I mean, over blowing up buildings, when I was 13, it was just at the point, I used to make sandcastles all the time, particularly on top of Shotover, when there was still sand in the sandpit, which somebody who's really empathetic needs to take some sand up and dump it in that sandpit, by the way. And it was around about 13, I stopped destroying them. You know, small boys, after you finish making one, before you go home, you destroy the sandcastle. Or actually realising you could leave this thing for other people to play with. And maybe I was lucky and I got through that stage and he hadn't. I have once been in... and maybe I was lucky, maybe people who are less... pathetic or less pro-social, often fairly horrible things have happened to them. Robert Peston wrote a very nice book in which he detailed the fairly horrible things that had happened to people at the top of business in Britain. I have been in this situation once. I was asked by a group of board-level bankers for a dinner in the Gherkin to talk about inequality, and I asked one of them towards the end, why have you asked me here? And he said because his son had stopped speaking to him at Christmas because he saw him as part of the problem. So what gets somebody is a longer conversation from somebody they trust who is nearer to them. And the reason the son had stopped talking to his father who was a banker is that the son had been recruited by People and Planet, who are based on the Cowley Road, at some university somewhere. So if you're involved in People and Planet, you know, the long-term potential impact is great. But it's slow, and I really think we need to be more careful about realising people have very different beliefs, and some of them are simply because some people will feel much less empathy than others and get really personally upset when somebody says, you shouldn't be quite as greedy.
Oh, that's one of the most encouraging things I've heard for a long time. That suggests that the hard core of this inequality that we have in our society, there's an amazing mindset which I find incredible. If you take, for example, the no-frills, low-cost airline, EasyJet, the chief executive of EasyJet earns 1,000 times as much as her lowest paid employee. She's paid £7 million a year. An American lady chief executive, I'm sure she's very smart, very clever, and she runs the organisation that well, but I don't believe any organisation of any colour or quality is worth 1,000 times what you pay the person who sweeps up around the airport terminals. I just don't think that's right. But what you've said is hugely encouraging to me. I'm a mature student at university. I'm one of the oldest students at one of the Oxford colleges. And I'm particularly interested in business and especially in inequality. And this has grown the last, you quoted the last 5 years, I think the last 25 years perhaps. An extraordinary situation where this lady can drive into her office desk every day without the slightest qualms about being in that position. Now, when I was in industry, I was paid very well in modern terms, it's a very substantial salary. Nothing ever, by comparison, never, you know, several hundred times as much as the lowest paid employees in the company.
Yeah.
1,000 times. It's crazy. But what you've said about those being closest to us, who've had the greatest influence, says something important, because those younger people who belong to the social media zone, if you like, the new social media zone, which is full of frivolity at the moment, but I think is going to become a serious player in society, that's the way that this inequality will reach these younger people, and they will reflect upon it. You know, with them, I have a daughter, son-in-law and a daughter, who earn massive amounts of money, but and they work very, very hard indeed. Not 1,000 times.
Times harder.
500 no. times, 200 times, no. You know.
Yeah, I mean, one of the nice things is that there doesn't appear to be any evidence that greedy people necessarily produce greedy people or greedy grandchildren. whereas if there is, you could be in a little cocoon, you know, of a family. We all said you're great.
Yeah.
The other side on this, on justice and equality for somebody getting $7 million a year, one of the nicest things that Thomas Piketty slipped into his very big book was the idea of extreme meritocracy. That one argument you can have that you should be getting $7 million a year is that some of the children of the super rich of the world will just get $7 million a year from their trust fund. Mm. So the only way you're going to equal that out is if you are paid $7 million too, then at least it's fair that you're getting the same as somebody who's not doing anything at all. So it's an idea of justice to defend having an enormous amount of money. And I think one mistake people like me have made is just to think that there are a group of people who know they're bad, but are just trying to get away with it, and not realising that it's actually a group of people who really think that right and morals are on their side, and often that God is telling them to do this as well.
Do you have any empathy with Roark?
With the architect?
Do you understand where he's coming from at all? Could you see anything that he's...
No, but I was brought up by hippies. Even though I'm good at maths, I was brought up by 1960s hippies. I'm trying to think...
Always the politician who you
I could see for him the idea of striving and making it through. Yes, for the politician's easier. People will try and exploit you. They'll try and pay you a low wage if you've managed to do all of this. And he presumably thinks he became a board level member at 25 because he's truly amazing. He may not understand probabilities and that they decided they're going to have somebody. So if you decide you're going to have a 25-year-old board member, somebody's going to be it. It's really easy to convince yourself. You know, if you get a first at university or something else, it's really easy to convince yourself it's you and not that they're simply slots that have to be filled by somebody. So I've got sympathy for him. I do find this idea of people on the right thinking they're doing public service by taking a much lower amount of money than they could do. You know, they could work in the city and get paid far more than being a politician. Hard to understand, but it makes sense that that's what they're doing. Where I don't have sympathy is people like Ian Duncan Smith, who I don't think Ian Duncan Smith is so stupid that he doesn't understand that his actions are resulting in deaths. But I could be wrong. I'm sure that his actions are resulting in people dying. The question is whether Ian understands that or not. And I've got a horrible feeling he does, and he thinks it's necessary. And that's the point my empathy goes. Or for somebody who's willing for other people to die for their idea of an efficient society.
I was just wondering, just watching that clip and the close-ups of, I mean, I have to admit, I don't know the Fountainhead, so I don't know, you know, the background, but seeing the close-ups of a woman's face, you know, looking at that man with that sort of longing.
Yeah.
And, I mean, even, and you know, in this highly unempathetic setting, you still needed some sort of kind of visual reminder that there has to be at least, you know, like one person in a way, you know, kind of sitting there and understanding you.
Yes.
Sort of like nodding along and going, yes, you know, or like, yes, this is the man I'm going to marry.
Yeah.
Which I don't know if I find it disturbing, but I mean, I was just wanted to kind of
throw
that in there.
So. Oh, no, it's really good. People with this politics, which is opposite to mine, really do need self. They get very high levels of doubt, unsurprisingly, given the general tenor that says you're nasty and bad. So the two times I saw it most recently were that when there was affirmation on the far right was Margaret Thatcher's funeral, where a senior minister told me the day after that when he heard the great west door of the cathedral open and the crowd cheering outside, he finally realised that they'd done the right thing all their lives and Maggie had been right. And the doubt he had been wrong when he heard the cheering of the crowds outside the funeral. I was semi-autistic enough to say to him, that was just the people who chose to be round the door. It's not representative of the UK. And he looked at me very angrily. He was obviously deeply emotionally involved in his funeral that just happened, and said, no, 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 the country was really with us all along, and I was wrong to have ever doubted it. And the other is the election result. You know, if you are in that party and an amazing 25% of adults have voted for you, and, you know, it's affirmation that the people want you. Apart from a few extreme psychopaths, everybody needs somebody to tell them they're wonderful. I should say, in the movie, I mean, the most disturbing thing about the fact that it's his favourite movie is that there's a rape scene of her. So how you could show this to your future wife as a good thing, I don't know. But there's a lot of sadism in Ayn Rand, and there's quite a lot of sadism on... It's a funny mix of extreme religion and extreme forms of sex and other things that goes on that side of stuff. Maybe the left is just boring, has flowers.
I'm fascinated about Javid watching that at 12, because I see an awful lot of what I call hubris. It's a word I use a lot. But people starting off okay, and then things happen, and they get better and better. They come to this point where somehow hubris seems to block out that moral compass they once had.
Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts on that in relation to this?
I think they've constructed themselves a new moral compass. And because they feel particularly strongly about their moral compass, they've decided to go into politics rather than to simply create wealth for a wider family and get yachts. David Freud would be an example. He left banking to design universal credit. Now, under New Labour and now under the Conservatives. Now, in one sense, universal credit could have been nice. As it is, we're getting the lowest forms of benefit in Western Europe. Okay, it's better than Greece, but that's about the only one. And the 12 billion of cuts, which will come on July the 8th, the only targets, once you take out pensioners, are people with disabilities, including any colleagues who are driving to work in an assisted car who needed a wheelchair, and children. And according to the IFS, the government are going to hit miss every single child poverty target as a result of the cuts that they will make. Now, the only way you can do things like that, unless you're mad, is to create a new moral compass that says, I don't know, the Lord on Sunday tells me to save the poor from themselves and from the benefit system and to get them on their feet, and it's good for them, and I'm making it better for the children of the poor by stopping their parents being so lazy. I think that's what's going on. And it's partly because the amount of church going by people in the government is so high. And I partly think it must be quite hard to do this if you don't think that God is telling you to do it. A bit like Tony Blair going to war. You know, it wasn't just George Bush telling him to go to war. Other voices were too. But I don't, you know, this is a long way away from being a geographer. You know, I'll put this in. The problem is, if you draw maps of things and you notice inequality is getting worse and you try to work out what's happening and you draw more maps and graphs, you know, eventually this is where it's led me into, you know, who is it who is deciding and why are they deciding? And this is the kind of thing which you can only see exposed in a country that's incredibly unequal at a time when it's incredibly unequal. So you don't see these kind of views expressed in normal OECD countries, and you didn't see these kind of views expressed in Britain in the past as vehemently and strongly as now.
There was something published in The Independent the other day which showed levels of inequality, income inequality, across most Western countries, and the United Kingdom and the USA were miles
above.
Denmark was the bottom.
Yeah.
Austria, countries like that, but you know, centred around a median sort of range, perhaps.
No, they're miles, and we don't know it. Our median family, the middle family in England, are worse off than the middle family in Germany and France, have a lower family income, before you even consider housing costs. And it's quite. Should we just do two more very quickly? You and then anybody else.
It's a slightly two-part question.
That might be the two then.
No, it's really. The first one's quick. I hope. How do you measure empathy as a geographer? You know, out in the field, if you're measuring it in society, you know, maybe just summarise it. And kind of more kind of social geography question, I guess, is: are there good examples of kind of any societies where empathy is increased or kind of exploded? I guess I think we need maybe an explosion of empathy in our society.
Of understanding.
And are there any examples of that, and how might that come about?
Okay. The first one, we're just stuck with questions the British Social Attitude Survey, because these questions have to have been asked a long time ago. So it makes the job much easier because there's so few questions you can chart. But questions about one law for the rich, one law for the others, people should stand on their own two feet. Since 1983, there have been about half a dozen of these. The scary thing, it waxes and wanes, but we are becoming more individualistic, particularly the young. In other ways, to answer to other questions about being nice to people, some things do get better, but there is an overall rise in individualism in this country and less empathy. Explosions of increased empathy, hard to measure. I'll give an anecdote. I saw one last week. Last week I was on the Greek island of Lesbos, in which 300 Syrians are arriving a day, quietly by dinghy, because it's 3 miles from Turkey, and the population of the island are taking them in and clothing them, despite the fact that they're facing destitution on the island. And that is happening all over the Mediterranean. There were thousands of people every day arriving from Syria. There were 3 Greek Navy ships who were looking the other way, because that's what you'd do if you were at all decent. It's an anecdote, but you can see it now. And if you want an equivalent example, go back to the Second World War and look at when this country finally at least allowed Jewish children in. We wouldn't let their parents in because we didn't like Jewish people, but we did allow the kinder transport to take place. So at these extremes, you get things, but it's largely anecdote, not measuring. Had to have one more question that's more upbeat on this one. On measuring, though, levels of violence are reducing. So it's different from empathy. But there's this dramatic overall level of violence amongst mainly men, and that may be one of the successes of 1970s feminism. Whether it results in greater empathy or not, I don't know. But so it's kind of all over the place. There's things you can measure and see, and there are good things. I should say the Greek islands tend to be the more left-wing parts of Greece, because it's where the communists were forced to send to prison camps when the junta took over. And one effect of that is that there aren't many Golden Dawn on the islands, which is what you need. Have we got a last question? Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think that with those benefit cuts, they seem to be affecting the poor, most vulnerable in society, yes. Also benefit sanctions as well,
yeah.
Are being much harder. Do you think that we won't actually get rid of injustice and inequality until we actually get rid of practices like those?
Yeah, and they're really, really recent.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't have these benefit sanctions 4 years ago. In 2013, I met Sarah Tever crying at Robin Hood's Bay, just by chance. There's a woman crying. I was going to go up to her and say, can I help? And then I saw it was Sarah Tever. And sadly, stupidly, I didn't say, can I help? Because I was slightly shocked that it was a government minister. And it was just before she resigned. In 2013, DWP had sanctioned 1.1 million people. The amount of money that they'd sanctioned from their benefits was more than the entire fines of every magistrate's court in England and Wales and every sheriff's court in Scotland combined. So we had taken more money off people on the bottom than we took in for all the fines from shoplifting and every other crime in the country. And that was 2013. That's why Sarah Tever went and said she couldn't be part of this thing. And I put it in this. At the time she resigned, I think it wasn't Vince Cable, certainly Clegg, maybe the Scottish one who used to be the leader, they said you need more of a backbone to be in the coalition. And these were the Liberals. Things got pretty bad after 2008. People have behaved in a reprehensible way. They've done the most terrible attacks on people who are at the very bottom of society. That is getting worse. It'll be my colleagues who I work with who are from Europe who will not get their child tax credits. So, it'll be the person who's disabled who can't come to work anymore. And it'll be all the poor children in the city who will see their living standards fall the most in the next few years. And I just think at some point people are going to get it. And this is the hope thing. I find it unbelievable to think we're going to go for the next 4.5 years. And everybody go, oh, that wasn't so bad then. You know, it partly because the story is so new. Most people don't know a lot of this. I'm constantly surprised every week by things I find out. I didn't know 6 weeks ago that the level of benefit sanctions had been so high. I didn't know that we had at least 50 deaths of people who had been sanctioned and suicides. Many thousands of suspected ones on top of that. It can get very, very depressing. But it isn't like the 2000s or the 1990s or the 80s. This is punitive and nasty and vindictive. But being carried out by people who think they are doing good, which makes it really scary, but more understandable.
It's not carried out by them, though, is it? It's carried out by the people in the social security offices and the who actually implement it.
Yeah, but the people at the top give them the targets and sack their manager.
I know that.
Oh, I agree. I think you shouldn't agree to do this. Yeah. But you end up with people in the job centres who are more marginal. I won't name any ministers. If you look at the civil service, well, it's interesting to see who works in the cuddly part that looks after animals and who looks in the part that detains asylum-seeking children, and how people sort themselves out between those different parts of our civil service. You could have people saying they're not willing to do this, but if you say you're not willing to do it, you can end up being one of the people being sanctioned rather than one of the ones doing the sanctioning. But people need to begin to say it's unacceptable and you shouldn't be proud of being part of this. There needs to be more talk in this way. Partly because people enacting it do think they are doing the right thing and they're doing good. And they're standing up for the individualistic society because there is no such thing as society. There are only individuals, there are only people with their own ideas. And the key thing, only a few people can be great inventors and great thinkers. And the mass of society is just a leech on them, including a few people who might want to take control of you and stop your greatness. And we need to be empathetic enough to understand that that is what they believe, and at least help them cause less damage, if not help them think in a different way. Thank you very much for listening to my rant. Thank you.